Welcome to Strange Familiars, covering a range of topics from the paranormal, cryptids, mythology, the occult, hauntings, UFOs, weird history, and folklore. Wherever you are listening to Strange Familiars, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or any other service, please subscribe and click the like button, and share the Strange Familiars pages and stories on Facebook and other social media. If you have experienced something strange, or if you know a story you would like us to cover, email strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. And of course, you can always find us at strangefamiliars.com.
Welcome to episode 12, Blind Joe Parsons. Before we get started, I'd just like to remind everybody about our Patreon. That's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. $3 a month, you can get extra shows and other bonus content. There's different reward levels there for things like t-shirts, stickers, and more. Our patrons there really help us out, and they really help us make Strange Familiars. So if you like what we're doing, please consider helping out. patreon.com/strangefamiliars. And of course, as always, I want to thank our current patrons. So tonight's show is one of our shows about history. There's not a terrible lot of paranormal stuff in this. There's some nice coincidences and some interesting stuff. This is a story that involves both Allison and myself, so she's going to be joining me again tonight. So this is a piece of history that was almost lost. I don't know that his story would have been lost because it was repeated quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a famous story, but we didn't know about it.
Yeah, and it's included in the famous like Civil War songbook.
Yeah, and a couple other like Civil War books for kids and mm-hmm. stuff. I think Civil War history buffs might know the story.
Yeah, but still, there's so many stories. It seems remote to know many of them.
When we found this, it was just an object. It wasn't a story. There was no story associated with it. It's just an object we found. And it's two stories, really. It's the story of Joe Parsons, and it's kind of our story of finding it and discovering what it was. And it starts out with a walk. We've just taken a walk to the local antique shop, which is,
quarter of a mile up the road, maybe?
Yeah. It closed recently, unfortunately, right in our town. We go there frequently. And we walked in, and we found an old photograph, which was a tintype. Now, very quickly, let's go over the kinds of old photographs. Tintypes were not actually on tin.
No, they're on iron. That's why they're sometimes called ferrotypes.
On a very thin, like, iron plate.
Mm-hmm.
So tintypes aren't the oldest.
No, generally speaking, modern photography is credited as starting, like, in 1839 with Daguerre, where the name daguerreotype comes from.
Okay.
French photographer.
And that was a specific style. Those look kind of mirror-y.
Yeah, they look like, if you're looking at them trying to determine what's what, cased photographs like that can be daguerreotypes, amber types, or sometimes tin types that are cased in that same.
They look like tiny little books or little frames.
Yeah, with cool little hooks on the end.
Yeah, they're really interesting. It was daguerreotypes, amber types. Then came tintypes, basically.
In a rough sense.
Roughly. Mm-hmm. And then we're still in the 1800s here.
Yeah, very, yeah.
During the Civil War, CDVs begin to come in.
Yeah, but tintypes are great because they're like the first sort of egalitarian, really cheap, easy to come by photography.
So probably a lot of wealthy people had daguerreotypes and so forth.
Yeah, I think like because of the nature of the war and because of the nature of tintypes, they become a kind of a perfect match because you have now a cheap, accessible way to produce photography and also to get photography in the hands of people that weren't able to maybe go to a larger town where a professional studio would be set up. We could have roaming,
traveling photographers, and so forth. Just quick before we get back to our story, after the tintype comes the CDV generally, and that's on paper, right?
Yeah, and there, I mean, some of that starts to come in about the same time as the tintypes, but just as in an easy way of thinking of it, tintypes kind of have their heyday around the time of the Civil War.
Okay, and then the CDV is like the little cards, but it's paper. It's a paper image.
Yeah, and if you think of like what you would think of as a calling card or a, sort of like a proto-business card, they're a little bit larger than that.
And a lot of, towards the end of the war, or in the middle of the war, a lot of people were getting those. A lot of soldiers would get them to give them away to their sweethearts or their
friends. Or to carry a photograph with them.
Yeah. Later, after the CDVs, come the cabinet cards, which take us into the early 1900s.
Exactly. And then you start to get more mounted cards that are even accessible to amateur people, like with the Brownie cameras and the first sort of the dawn of photography moving from a really professional setting to something that becomes a hobby.
In the 1800s, we generally know tintypes, a good rule of thumb is around the time of the Civil War.
Yeah, generally speaking.
And tintypes are very unique looking. If you don't know what tintypes are, Allison and I collect old photographs. We have for
almost 20 years, probably.
20 years, a long time. I love tintypes. I think you put it that they're a little bit more dimensional, like they seem like they have more depth.
Yeah, they have more depth, I think, than paper photography does, even though sometimes paper photography is a little clearer. And that's a lot of the tintypes have a lot to do with who's taking the photo.
Right.
There's a lot to be said for skill at this point.
Tintypes in general, they have kind of a dull, silvery look to them. Very interesting. I've always loved the way they look before I even knew what they were.
They do have sort of a haunting look because they're all gray tones, sort of shadowy.
Yeah. And you were saying that there's no negative for these, so they're one-off images.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they would do a bunch of them on a plate, but they were usually different images.
So in general, there's not a glass negative somewhere.
No, there isn't.
If you have a tintype, you have an original, most likely.
Yeah.
So we walk to this local antique store, and I find this tintype of a guy in dark glasses sitting there. He's got a beard. He just looked neat. I took him to you and you said, oh, that's a blind man. That's neat. Let's get that image. And it was $7, right?
I think.
And you said, well, where'd you find that? Let me go see. So I took you back to that stand and there were other carts there, cabinet cards and photos going into the early 20th century.
Yeah.
You bought most of them, but not all of them at the time, which is important. This mm-hmm. comes back as part of the story later, but you did buy a lot of these photographs.
Yeah, I think initially there was an album, like it wasn't an antique album. Someone had kind of made an album out of the family members.
Yeah, they just
and
had
there
a
was,
bunch
yeah, and there was
of
a lot of, just a ton of photos. It just seemed like a good deal in general. I don't even know if initially I realized it was the same family. I think I just happened to get them on the same day.
Yeah. And we said, oh, let's just grab all these photos. And again, we didn't get all of them. We bought a good chunk of what was there, but not all of them. So we take all the pictures home, and the tintype is in a little cardboard...
Like a paper sleeve.
Like a paper sleeve.
It's like a paper mat. And it's sealed with the original, so it's never been taken out of there, so we know it belongs to that initially.
And tintypes sometimes come in these, sometimes not. Sometimes you just find them loose. Sometimes they'll be rusted. I think that's, some of the really neat as if the metal, it's very thin iron that they're printed on. So
the emulsion cracks and it exposes a part that can become rusty.
Yeah, sometimes they'll get rusty. And yes, these are printed on iron. So we're tying back to the last couple shows unintentionally, really. But this is in its original case, like you said, a thin paper kind of. It's like a little frame that they put them in. And on the back is written Uncle Joe Parsons. So it's identified, probably.
Yeah. From a ancestor standpoint, it is. As much as when you write Mom on it or,
exactly.
or Aunt Sally.
Well, he had a name and he was an interesting looking guy. It's a really great picture.
Yeah. And he doesn't, to me, he looks sort of not even of his time.
Yeah, it's kind of timeless.
He has a really sort of much more updated quality to him. Like, if you saw a picture of someone now that looked like that, it wouldn't seem out of place.
No, he could be sitting on the street in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So we had a name, and I just typed it into Google. I just said, well, let's see what comes up. So I type in this name, Joe Parsons, and we knew he was blind, so I put blind in Joe Parsons, or Joe Parsons blind. I'm not sure which order I typed it in. And this incredible story comes up.
Oh. a Maryland hero. He was a bold soldier boy with his eyes shot out, his heroic act. In the early part of the war, Jury Commissioner Mansfield was in Fauquier County, Virginia, fighting in several skirmishes around Fairfax Courthouse. A bullet in the shoulder incapacitated me for a few days, and I had to have it cut out at a temporary hospital in the rear of our lines, said Colonel Mansfield not long ago, as he revived some of his old war experiences. In this hospital, I noticed one day a soldier leaning out of a window. He had a broad bandage over his eyes, and I knew he couldn't see, for he was straining forward in a rather dangerous position. All the time he was singing, "I'm a bold soldier boy," etc. Seeing his perilous attitude, I walked up and pulled him back, telling him that he was leaning out too far and might take a tumble. "All right, sir," said he. "I can't see, you know." "What's your name?" I asked, "and where are you from?" "Joe Parsons," he answered, "from Maryland." He had been wounded in one of the first skirmishes in the Virginia hills. A mini-ball had passed directly through his eyes, forever destroying the sight. The fellow, who was only 20 years old, was as happy as a lark. While I stood looking at him, he again broke out joyously, "I'm a bold soldier boy." I was morbidly interested in him. "It's dreadful," I remarked, hoping to draw him out to tell me his story. "It might have been worse," he answered laconically. "I might have been killed." Alas, the poor fellow was too young to realize this miserable affliction. "How did you get here?" I asked, wondering if he had crawled to the place or had been found and carried to it. "After I was hit," he told me, "I lay all night in the grass where I had fallen. The pain was pretty bad, but what worried me more than anything else was that I couldn't hear anybody or anything. It was so still. I didn't know where I was, and as I couldn't see, I had no way of knowing where I could get to, even if I did attempt to crawl away. Soon the firing began again, and the balls whistled all around me. Then I did make an attempt to get out of the way, and crawled about a dozen yards in what I supposed a backward direction, when I heard a fellow groan. "Hello," I said. "Hello," said he. "Who are you?" I asked. "A rebel?" "I reckon I am," answered the man, whom I could not see. "And you must be a Yankee," he continued. "That's what," said I. "Where are you hurt?" "Leg smashed," answered the Confederate. "Can't you see?" "No." "Can you see?" "Oh, yes, I can see well enough." "Well, then, let's help each other," I said. "My eyes are shot out, but I'm pretty good on my legs. And with them in your eyes, we ought to be able to get out of this. You pile onto my back and steer me where to go." This the fellow did, and we were soon underway. Now and then we had to rest a spell and take a drink out of his canteen. When he told me to stop, where do you suppose he had steered me? Right into the tent of a Confederate officer. The captain came up and asked us where we had come from. I told him, and caught me by the hand, and told me that he reckoned I was done for and couldn't do any more shooting. He asked me if I wanted to go home, and I begged him to send me over to our lines. He'd have done it without the asking, he said, and again grabbed me by the hand. Next day he sent me over on a transport after his surgeon had bandaged my eyes. That young lad had grit, concluded Colonel Mansfield, for as I passed on, his clear, shrill voice sang out again, "I am a bold soldier boy." St. Louis Republic.
So we have this story of this Civil War hero. And the question becomes, do we have the right Joe Parsons?
Yeah, it's a pretty common name, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, how many blind guys named Joe Parsons were there at the time? How can we be sure, though?
Mm-hmm.
Could have been somebody wrote on the back of this that they thought that's who it was. We don't know for sure until we start looking at the other photos that we bought with it. And these photos were also identified.
Yeah, one says the name of his brother, So you started to see the Parsons name repeat again. And then there was one photo that was really kind of the turning point in that it was a group of sisters that all had the names and their birth dates. And it said to their brother, Reuben, that was the key.
So we had names of his family. And now you could look and do the genealogy.
And then it started to fall together really quickly.
So we know we have the right Joe Parsons.
Because once I do the genealogy, I can even see on the census that it's marked that he's blind.
Right.
Because that was a common thing to mark.
So we know it's the Joe Parsons from the article, which is pretty incredible. There are other pictures of him amongst the family in later years. We're pretty sure it's him. Mm-hmm. But as far as a photo of Joe Parsons at the time of the Civil War, this may be it.
Yeah, I imagine this is probably right after, either during the time he was staying in the medical hospital or maybe shortly afterward.
Yeah, it had to be right around that time.
Yeah, it could even be something that he had a picture taken of to send back to his family just to kind of say, hey, I'm doing fine, you know, kind of thing.
We looked for pictures of his unit. We looked for other pictures of him in uniform. We could find none of that. Mm-hmm. They may be out there. If they are, if somebody can put us in touch with those pictures somewhere, that'd be great. He was in Baltimore. He was
the Maryland 1st Regiment, I think.
Maryland 1st Regiment. And, of course, he fought in Antietam, and that's where he was blind. But I think we probably have the only photo of him at the time.
Some other rogue part of the family that got a different group of pictures has it.
Exactly. But, yeah. It could be. We have the only photo of Joe Parsons at the time. We're certain that it's the Joe Parsons in the article. The family moved to Ohio then.
Yeah, eventually they settled in Ohio.
And you can see that on the census and so forth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was somehow we knew those photos came from a lot from Ohio.
Almost all of them say, the photographer on them, almost all of them say Belleville, Ohio.
Okay. So that was another way we tracked them. The family moved by the census, and the other photos mm-hmm. came from Ohio. And Joe's incredibleness doesn't stop with his being a hero in the Civil War and his apparently wonderful attitude in the hospital. He becomes a horse trainer.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. I mean, really, the logistics of it.
And we found two articles. There's an early one that we'll have you read.
This is from the Pantograph in Bloomington, Illinois, June 5th, 1880. Joseph Parsons bought Ed Benton's horse. Joe was totally blind, but a good judge of horse flesh. He led the horse home with as much facility as if he had his sight. He goes by the sense of feeling in everything and seldom makes a mistake. He married his wife without seeing her and has no cause of complaint.
This incredible man has this incredible story already. If he does nothing else than carry that Confederate soldier off the battlefield, he's had an incredible story.
Yeah.
And now he's a blind horse trainer. And we have another story about how well he trained these horses.
Joseph Parsons, the blind horse tamer, has taught a horse to follow him all around town, indoors and out of doors, upstairs and downstairs, without being guided by the hand. We would not be surprised if Joe would learn a horse to lead him in the same way, a feat not more difficult when we consider his total blindness.
Part of our story, part of it for me, is thinking about what would have happened if we didn't buy this photo. What could have happened if mm-hmm. we didn't buy this photo? And there's every chance it could have been lost to time. I mean, someone could have bought it and not done the research.
Yeah, in fact, I went back a few months ago just to see that stand because I was in the antique store anyway, and the stand was gone. Said that the lady that owned it had to sell everything at auction, and none of the remaining photos were there.
So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, if we hadn't gotten it and it sold at auction, it could have been spread into 15 different lots somewhere. And
yeah, somebody could have bought it. And
even with the most diligent research, had no way to prove that that's who it was.
Exactly. And the other thing about when things get sold in lots, I mean, we know this from going to auctions sometimes somebody will buy a lot to get you know, there might be photographs and something else
that they actually wanted to.
They want the something else. They don't care about the photographs. Yeah. They'll buy that lot of stuff to get the something else. And the photographs, if they're not a reseller, if they don't know anything about photographs, those photographs are done.
A lot of times I've had people say, oh, I just threw out boxes of photographs. I didn't know anyone collected them.
Yeah. Maybe somebody else could have found it and they would have done the research.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, it's quite possible, but it's also possible that this could have been lost to time. So the photograph would have been lost. His story, I think, stays.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the photograph connected us to his story. It connected us to this piece of history. To me, it just became a really cool thing.
It went from being really abstract to very humanized.
Absolutely. And I really feel like we have a piece of history, which is odd because... maybe we'll talk about this on other shows. I don't feel like it's the only piece of really important history we own, and we're not wealthy people.
I think that's kind of the thing that from this that also kind of haunts me. It's like how much history is getting thrown away every day misplaced.
How much are we missing?
Yeah.
So do your research, or let us do your research. Happily, it came into a house where we actively... like doing research and we love this kind of thing. So I'm very happy we own this. I feel privileged. We thought it was a good enough story where we thought, let's take it to the Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
So here's another part of the story. I'll say me going into it, I was 1,000% convinced that this story was going to blow them away and we were going to be on TV, we were going to be featured, it's going to knock them out. I was a bit naive.
I pretty much just wanted to make a connection with someone who could sell it for me if I came up with a really great price or if could put me in touch with someone who could get it to the right people to keep it in a museum somewhere.
We go to the Antiques Roadshow. Co-worker of yours, very, very kindly.
Yes, thank you to Christy for giving me her tickets.
Very kindly gave us tickets, and we wait in line. They send us to the photography people first.
Yeah.
And we show the photography lady, the specialist in photography, and she says, oh, this is very interesting. Go see the military guy. And she gives us a little piece of paper that basically says, go to the head of the class. You know, you get to skip the line. It was a very short line for photography. I think that we might have been the only people in it, or maybe there was one person in front of us.
If you're going to the Antiques Roadshow, photography is a good thing to bring.
And the military line was massive, maybe the longest line in the place.
Behind paintings, maybe. Yeah.
And we got to skip to the head of it, which was pretty nice. We go, and then there's one person in front of us to see the military guy.
Yeah, who also had an amazing hair work. Shadow box.
Hair work is a Victorian
morning practice,
and we're going to get into that in another show. Mm-hmm. But we go up and see the military guy, and he's looking at it, and we had the newspaper article printed out, and we had the photograph with us, and we had all of our research done, and he's reading the article, and he's looking up at us, and he's looking over at the picture, and he goes back to reading the article, and he's looking at the picture, and looks at us, and he says, "This is incredible." He says, this is the best story I've heard all day. He says, I'm shaking reading this article. And of course, I'm thinking, yes, we're going on TV. This is it. He's going to send us over. The way the Antiques Roadshow is laid out for people who've never been there, all the experts and estimators and so forth are around the outside, kind of in a circle, while they're filming the main part of the show in the center of this sort of ring.
And it all takes place in a very kind of small area,
I think, really. Considering they could have really spread out through that arena we were in, they didn't take up much area. So I'm thinking he's going to send us into the center.
Basically, he did say, this is the coolest thing I've seen all day.
He did. He said, this is incredible. I can't wait to tell the other guys, you know, the other military guys. And he kind of just sent us on our way.
Yeah. Wah,
wah. It's just like, okay, you're done. He did say he thought it was worth about $1,000. That's the price he put on it, which I think it's worth personally a lot more than that to the right person, to the right collector of maybe a Civil War stuff or of Antietam stuff or of wounded soldiers, identified soldiers. It's possibly worth a lot more than that. I don't really care. I'm not going to sell it for $1,000.
I feel like a lot of times that's sort of an arbitrary.
It's the history I'm interested in. I mean, I would like to see it go on display somewhere. I would consider loaning it if Antietam has a museum or a place to display it. I would consider, you know, loaning it to them. It feels to me far more important than $1,000.
Yeah, and maybe that's just because we do kind of romanticize that idea of plucking someone from obscurity and giving them back their immortality.
Right, and because it's become such a personal story for us.
Yeah.
You know, our story of finding it and of doing the research has become part of the story for us. But whatever the case, I'm not going to part with it for $1,000. Later on, it must have been you who said to me, you know, they probably know what they're going to put on these shows before they ever come to town.
To an extent.
They're not going to leave it to chance.
Yeah.
And it made a lot of sense. We don't know. I'm going to have to say we don't know. That's the way Antioch works.
Some of it could be sort of serendipity, but I have a hard time believing
that. But that would make sense. If I was putting on a TV show, I would want to do that. Mm-hmm. I would want to know for a fact, because you can't leave that to chance. You're there for one day, 2 days, whatever it is.
And there's certainly things that skew really to a certain niche audience that are very popular. You know, it's people like to see certain things. I don't know why they do all that boring China then. But
but anyway, it would make sense. Again, we don't know. We don't really have any inside working knowledge other than the fact that we saw the layout of how they do it.
Yeah.
But we don't know how they really choose what goes on. But it would make sense. Like, if I was putting on a show, I wouldn't leave it to chance. If I had to roll in and I was going to be in a place for a day or two,
yeah,
I wouldn't leave it to chance that someone might show up with something cool. That's how I'm consoling myself, I suppose.
I don't feel like I wasn't expecting that kind of experience, so that doesn't really bother me.
Oh, I just thought we had the best story in the world. You know, I thought it was not in the world, but I thought we had a great Antiques Roadshow story.
It's a great American story. This is a story of humanity.
What an incredible, mm-hmm. I mean, what an incredible guy, what an incredible story for him to pick the enemy soldier up and put him on his back. And He's blind. He's been hit in the face with a mini ball. And he picks the guy up and says, let's get off this battlefield. Incredible. They did film a little segment of us in the feedback booth, the little thing they put at the end. So maybe we'll be on. Who knows?
Along with all the people that are acting like ridiculous. Like
at the end.
Yeah.
The feedback booth segment.
They like the silly people.
I don't imagine they'll contact us and tell us that hey, you made the feedback.
See, are you
segment.
Still thinking that this is a possibility for this part of it, that you're going to be picked for this part of it too?
I guess it's a possibility. They did film it.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? The woman filming it said, wow.
Well, there you go.
For whatever that's worth. But the story doesn't quite end there. There's one little extra part, which is really, really neat, and it comes down to a bit more of a coincidence or synchronicity.
To me, there's two more interesting parts, and that is that the family line that ends the genealogy...
Oh, yes.
...also happens to be two people that were really instrumental in collecting circus memorabilia, which is...
So as you're doing the genealogy for mm-hmm. Joe, for Joe Parsons, you find that... Two of his relatives.
Yeah, and these are like the last people. This is probably the estate that was sold where whoever the antique dealer bought it from. Like, it's their stuff, basically.
And they were circus collectors.
Which and when I was like, why does this name sound so familiar to me? And I looked it up and I was like, yeah, I've seen it before, because there's a whole collection of their estate, of their circus memorabilia at a particular college out in the Midwest. You know, in old issues of the circus magazine White Tops, I just found one today, actually. It was a half-page ad they had taken out to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, and there's their name.
Wow. So there's the circus connection. You collect or, you know, circus stuff and do the research on a lot of the performers. The other one is pretty neat, too. So this is after we went to the roadshow a little while.
But probably 2 years after the initial time that we found the photograph.
So 2 years after we bought the photograph, roughly. We're in another sort of junky antique shop across town. It's really on the other side of the county, really, mm-hmm. from where we live. we happen to be looking through boxes. He has boxes of books and boxes of this and boxes of that. And we found a box of photographs and we're kind of just flipping through quickly. And we thought, well, you know, this guy doesn't really deal in photographs. Let's just take the whole box up to the counter, see if he'll just sell us the whole box.
Yeah, and he sold us the whole box, which is nice.
Yeah, it gave us a very good price. He was happy. We were happy. We walked out with these old photographs. And as you're looking through, you start laughing.
Yeah, I start to see people that look familiar. There's a specific wallpaper pattern, which is like really ornate, that's in the background of a lot of the Parsons family photos. And there it is again.
It happened to be the rest of the lot from the antique store in our neighborhood.
I assume what happened is when all of her things were sent to auction, this guy just buys box lots. And that's how it ended up in his junk shop.
So we ended up with the rest of these Parsons, or whatever was left of these Parsons family photos in the end, which I thought was a...
And we hadn't been to that antique store in probably 15 years, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's not something we would hit regularly. The one in town, when we found the Joe Parsons photo, we would hit regularly just because it's a walk.
But this one was like just totally...
Yeah, it's just a random day.
It had to have been just recently, because he just moves things so quickly because they're so cheap there. It had to have been just recently that he got it, or it wouldn't be kind of at the top of his junk pile for us to see.
Yeah,
I wonder if that's where the copies of the magazines came from, too.
You got a bunch of those White Top Circus magazines.
Yeah.
In the same store. So, yeah, it could have been. They could have come all the way from Ohio.
Yeah.
In that same lot. So that was a very interesting little... another knot in the thread.
Yeah, I mean, like, for me, this is the closest to paranormal I get, is this idea that, like, history is kind of pulling me towards certain objects. Like, that's probably the closest I'm going to get.
Allison is our resident skeptic. But, hey, I'll take it. I love that kind of synchronicity. It's just pretty amazing. If we weren't in the right place at the right time, we didn't get any of it.
Yeah.
Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, darkhollerarts.com, music, books, podcasts, and more, darkhollerarts.com. Intro and background music is by Stonebreath, stonebreath.bandcamp.com if you want to hear more. And our reader this episode was Sarada.
Now when the storms of fate are cast,